Price, and this is Price Talks. Price Talks celebrating a 30-year anniversary. What happened back then in 1989? I was a city councilor, and with a bit of prodding from one of the guys in the room here, moved a motion to council that we set up a task force on what we called atmospheric change. That's a nice bureaucratic way of talking about climate change back then, when hardly anyone was. Out of that came what you may know as Clouds of Change Task Force. But that's probably the first kind of task force of its kind in, well, maybe anywhere, certainly as far as a municipality. What motivated me, in addition to encouragement, was the previous year, where a guy named James Hansen had appeared before the American Senate and basically said, that global warming thing, yeah, it's real. It's starting. You'd want to maybe do something about that. And in that 30 years, well, that's kind of the story we're going to talk about today with Mike Brown, who was one of the members of that Clouds of Change Task Force. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you're going to take some credit for getting Clouds of Change going. What was motivating you?
I was not involved in any form of environmental activity of any sort until 2 years before that, 1987. I'm an entrepreneur and an investor, an early stage investor in up to that stage, what you would loosely call technology, software, data over radio, that sort of thing. But I was introduced to a company in North Vancouver called Ballard Power, which thought that it would be a neat idea to take some experimental work on building fuel cells and see whether or not you could actually build a fuel cell that was large enough and efficient enough and cheap enough to power a car.
The energy crisis still would have been within recent memory.
Yes, yes. But the fundamental driving force here was that it was clear in many parts of the world that local air quality was becoming a political issue. And the most outstanding place that was doing research was in California, in the Los Angeles Basin, where there was an organization called the South Coast Air Quality Management District, or SQAMD. And in order to determine whether or not there really was a market for this kind of hardware, I went down there. And I met with the executives of SQAMD for 2 days in a row. Two full days. I had a great time. And I met a guy called Jim Lentz, who ran it, and some others. And they convinced me that local air quality was the interim problem, that the long-term problem was this thing called climate. And so I came back to Vancouver and started to get interested in this, and definitely added it to the portfolio of ideas that consequently led to the original investment in Ballard Power in 1987.
About that investment, are we talking about your money? Are you one big rich guy?
No, I'm not a big rich guy. I'm a big guy, right? But I lose 25 pounds and I'd still be big. No, I was one of the founders of an organization called Ventures West, which was a prototype of venture capital activity in this country. In fact, we started the original one in 1968. So I've been in the business for 50 years. And up to that stage, we had not done any environmental type businesses. We were on the lookout for a mixture of things. So we had money by that stage from some significant corporate and institutional investors. And I think we had about, if I recall correctly, that fund had about $50 million in it, which in those days was a lot of money. We had significant discretion over how we spent the money. And together with the Business Development Bank, we put $1,350,000 into Ballard. And that is the origin of what we know now as one of the world's real leading fuel cell companies.
I would think that a lot of people, not me, would say, hey, venture capitalists, they're kind of antithetical to, in fact, environment and trying to preserve things rather than make money.
It's an ongoing issue, because if we're, it's not just isolated to 30 years ago. It continues to be a fundamental problem with technological progress in the climate side. I've since done some work, and we could talk about how I got to these other spaces, which indicate that within a couple of decades, the annual cost that we should be prepared to pay if we're going to solve the problem is measured in the sub-tens of trillions of dollars per annum. I mean, by 2050, we're talking of at least $8 or $9 trillion per annum of technology solutions that do not exist today.
Trillion makes my head hurt.
Yes, it's a big number.
Let's come back to that.
Yes.
I want to know more about you. Where are you from?
Here.
Or
right
here.
Right here. My grandmother was born about a half a mile away, right where the Sinclair Center is. And she was born here in 1889. Her dad had showed up in 1886. I met him, actually. I met my great-grandfather, which not many people do. And so she was born here. My dad was born here. I was born here. My kids were all born here. And most of their kids were born here. So there's five generations of us have lived in Vancouver.
Is that what gives you some sense of concern about this habitat that we live on?
Oh, this is all about my... when I started thinking about this problem, I conceived it was going to be something that would face my great-grandchildren. By the time we got to sort of mid-90s, it was about my grandchildren. By the time we got to like 2005, it was about my children. And now it's about me. In other words, the issues that we discussed back at the Clouds of Change days, where a lot of people thought we were wildly pessimistic as to the speed with which we were facing this crisis, it turned out we were wildly optimistic. This is happening faster than those of us who started getting interested in it 30 years ago, I think, could possibly have conceived. So this is about my children and my grandchildren and their children. And one of the things that gives me great hope is that without any prompting from me, my grandchildren are, you know, going on strike on Fridays. And I think it's terrific. I mean, I'm not promoting civil disobedience yet. But if we don't get our answers right, civil disobedience might be the only thing that saves us.
Mike, when you hang out in the equivalent of the Vancouver Club, maybe the Vancouver Club, amongst your peers, how does that kind of rhetoric go down?
It's surprising. In the last 5 years, that kind of rhetoric has had a lot more acceptance among those kinds of people. So I was at a function last night honoring my long-term partner, Haig Ferris, who became a BC Business Laureate at a junior achievement thing. And you'd think that at that audience, not many people would care about this. But I approached several of my peers and younger people, down to my kids' age. My kids are all in their 50s. And I would talk to them about what they were doing with their careers. And I'd say, one guy in particular, I said, his name was Andrew, and I won't tell you his last name. I don't want to embarrass anybody. But Andrew, have you thought of taking your experience and applying it to the climate side? Have you thought, you know, you're an entrepreneur, you're a teacher of entrepreneurialism. Why would you not take that and actually directly apply it to seeing if there are enterprises that you could help start and grow that are going to count for something more than just making a bunch of money? And maybe it's because his wife was standing there sort of looking at him saying, I could see her eyes were in a sense sort of saying, why not? You know, he responded very positively to that message. And he admitted to me that he had never thought of it that way. So I think what's happened in the last while is that we've come to recognize that the concerns that our children and our grandchildren are having, and by that I mean the generation anywhere from like 12 years old to 50 years old, are realizing that it's those kids that we're now protecting. And this really is an existential problem.
It's a fair use of the word.
Can
we continue to exist?
Absolutely correct. Now, I think that people my age, frankly, the worst I'm going to see are, you know, the costs of fighting fires and a few floods and things like that, that I'm not casting aspersions at them being serious and expensive. But the real issues are going to turn up after I'm dead.
Well, in the long run.
We all are. I understand that. And if I live to be my dad's age and he lived to be 90, in his 90s, I still won't see what are the real impacts. I will be able to see by then a lot more about what we're going to know 20 years from there than I can see, you know, 35 years from today.
Well, in that time, do you think you can make a buck on this? Have you got ideas for investing?
Yes, I do. And those ideas were born out of seeing the outcome of some federal, some relatively far outward-looking federal organizations that I think stumbled. A particular one is the one called Sustainable Development Technology Canada that was started in 2000. It's a consequence of a collaboration between a guy called Jim Stanford, who most people never heard of, but he was the president of Petro-Canada at the time the government sold its last $1 billion worth of Petro-Canada stock. And he collaborated with Paul Martin to set up this thing called Sustainable Development Technology Canada with $1 billion of funding to be used to pay, make grants to companies that had interesting climate change technology. Now, it's interesting that most Canadians have never heard of this thing. And I was on this board for 15 years, and I saw a lot of companies go by. I think by the time I left at the end of 2015, it had invested in something like 240 companies. But my observation was, out of the 240, only five were going to make a difference. The rest were interesting things and presented great opportunities for politicians to cut ribbons, talking about the money that the government had put in to help this local enterprise create jobs and so on. But the fact of the matter was that it wasn't going to make a big enough difference. None of them were, except for maybe five. And the analysis that had been done I think failed to take into account what the real object ought to be. And I think the real object ought to be to find the things that are going to make significant breakthrough differences. Things that tackle big markets. Things that tackle them in ways that have never been done before. And so together with some friends, I tried to persuade SDDC to change its strategy. It didn't succeed. But decided with some friends that maybe we could do this privately. So we started an organization. It's a company. It's called the Institute for Breakthrough Energy Technology. And if you look at the acronym, it's IBET, I-B-E-T. It's a company, even though it's called an institute. And so what we decided to do was see if we could find marketplaces that would help establish hardware technology, hardware and software technology are extremely different in that software are basically involved with companies that you can check out within relatively short period of time, relatively small amounts of money, whether you've got a chance to make it work or not. Hardware is not the same. Hardware, you can figure out that it's not going to work. But in order to make it work, you have to go through product development cycles. You have to go through test cycles. You have to prove to somebody that if they want it to last for 20 or 30 years, you got to run some experiments to make it last for 20 or 30 years. And in the course of doing that, it turns out that what you're testing is no longer interesting because something new's come along. So hardware is a real, real problem. But hardware has got to be the answer. So we said, is there a way to shortcut the hardware game and still make it look like it's going to be profitable? Because if you don't make it profitable, you can't get the huge amounts of capital that are going to be needed. I mean, you know, you may say the capitalist system doesn't work very well, but right now it's the only thing we got in terms of putting money into enterprises, that we better figure out how to shorten that time frame and make it serious. So our criteria is whatever the marketplace is and the technology that's going to be applied has to solve 2% of the problem. And you say, 2%? That doesn't sound like very much.
It doesn't, Mike.
But 2% of several $1 trillion a year is a big number. And so four of us set this up. And our target, by the time I am my dad's age, which would be 13 years from now, I hope we've got four. In other words, from scratch, could we do things to address 8% of the problem.
What are you most hopeful about?
What I'm most comfortable and do that with projects that aren't going to run on forever. I mean, I'm a shareholder in a company I helped start, which is there are two of the country's longest running startups are in Vancouver. called D-Wave, which is building a quantum computer. And I was involved in that in the early going. It's nothing to do with this. And General Fusion, which is capable, frankly, to solve, I think, 15% of the problem. But it's been going for 20 years. Carbon engineering, which is the extraction of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, it can solve another 10 or 12%. So just in the lower mantle, and there's another one out here called Inventus that could probably, it's also carbon dioxide extraction, but different type. Between them, we've got the opportunity to solve 30% of the problem. I mean, this is astonishing stuff. 30% of the problem. So one of the policies that I think the government has to think seriously about is, what does solving 30% of the problem mean for us? Because we're not doing that. The government we're not addressing that.
Are you a hands-on capitalist, a technological optimist?
I'm not an optimist about anything.
All right.
How about optimism is
how about the capitalist?
Optimism is a denial
of
reality.
The only system we got.
Yeah.
Don't want to cut off some of your good lines here. But are you?
Frankly, I think that.
Part of the problem because you're a capitalist.
Yeah, probably.
Some would say?
Totally. I mean, I'm quite happy for people to think that that's the case, but I don't see any choice to access the money that we need. It's either got to be government. And I don't think there are a lot of people who think that government ought to be the front and center at this game, or it's got to be the marketplaces that control billions of dollars. And, you know, all the money we need is there. It's all there. So look, see what Bill Gates, the prime example of what a capitalist is all about. Bill Gates has created Breakthrough Energy Ventures. And he's got a bunch of his buds together, and they have $1 billion of capital at their disposal, and they're putting it to work, by the way. And it's that kind of for-profit, for long-term profit enterprise that we have to have.
Isn't one of the basic functions of capitalism, really any investor, is to assess risk?
Yes.
Why didn't capitalism, investors, government, assess that risk back in the 90s?
Some tried, and the streets of Silicon Valley are littered with the outcome of complete failure on the part of Silicon Valley to actually make this all work. And part of the problem was that these companies are not as easily assessed and grown as the standard hardware company. It's much harder even than most biotech companies. Most drug companies, which go through similar trial processes, albeit theirs are formal. You know, you got to pass regulation this and regulation that. And so they underestimated the amount of capital that would be needed, and they underestimated the time. So if you think about the way that the capital markets work, risk is a function not just of the money that's going to be required, but the time it takes to get there. So if I came to a big investor, for-profit investor, and I said, I have a deal for you, and yes, you're going to make a lot of money, and this is 2020, and by 2045, you should see your result, that's not a turn-on. That's too long a time frame. So you either have to shorten the time frame, or you have to reduce the amount of money, or you have to find an alternative solution to this multi-cycle problem of developing hardware. And so I think we found one. And they're called landing markets. So in the case of our first adventure in IBET, we have found, guess what, two oil sands companies that require hydrogen to power up their plants, but they need the hydrogen not to have any carbon dioxide associated with how you get the hydrogen. See, most hydrogen now is extracted from methane. It's extracted from carbon dioxide, from natural gas, CH4. And the typical way you extract it, it's called steam methane reforming. It's the least expensive way by far. But the byproduct is carbon dioxide. Well, guess what carbon dioxide is? It's the greenhouse gas we're all concerned about. Suppose you could extract the hydrogen and leave the carbon behind. Completely different problem, and do it for the same cost. So there's a couple of the oil sands companies that say, if you do that for us, terrific. We'll look through all of your, we'll help you through all of your beta sites and all of your test sites, and whatever you want to do with it from then on, be my guest. So Japan right now is actually extracting hydrogen from coal deposits in Australia, piping it to the coast, liquefying it, putting it on a boat to Japan as pure hydrogen. There are people in, and doing it for something like $4 or $5 a kilogram. And we think we could do it for a buck and a half.
So do these, let's go back to the tar sands.
Yeah.
Do you think the decision makers, the risk takers, now have a different kind of time frame? 30 years ago, climate change was a century away.
Yes.
That you can't assess risk for.
Yes.
Now, that existential threat, their ability to survive, not just as a company, but as people who live in a certain civilization, do they see that at risk, which justifies then a different strategy to investment?
Frankly, from my relatively limited exposure to current and previous executives in the business, the answer is when they go home at night, they worry about climate a lot. When they're in their business during the day, not so much. But after they've retired, yes. So I was on the verge of setting up an organization in Alberta where the Heritage Trust Fund was going to invest a lot of money in me and some my friends to do some alternative energy things. And our board was made up of old executives from the biz, right, from the oil and gas biz, who wanted to do everything they could to help us.
After they've retired.
After they've retired.
Is it something that if you're a current executive, a current decision maker, you can't take the risk of accepting the risk?
I think that's a good way to put it. I think that they all know that they've got to change their ways. And if they don't change their ways, they're in it for the short term.
I can understand that you would be a passive denialist.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if it seems a little much to say climate change is a bunch of crap, you just try and keep it off the agenda.
Oh, no, this
well,
has to
be... Well, let me give you my best example.
Yes, okay.
When Stephen Harper, our prime minister, went to the Arctic for 16 days, this was when he was in office. Words climate change never passed his lips.
Not
in
ever.
In the Arctic.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, come on. What I think that means is he was sending a message to other decision makers. You don't have to take this seriously. You can keep it off the agenda. We're not going to have an active strategy. You don't either.
I think that's precisely where he was going. He's not an active. There are a lot of governments that are passive in the denial process. They just don't want to do anything for all kinds of political reasons. Then we got our friends in the South who are actively trying to not do things. Stephen Harper was of the first category, I think. In other words, I think that he knows that there is a problem. He just didn't want to face the political downsides of being active about it.
I have to say, I'm a passive denialist in the sense that I fly. I think a carbon-intensive lifestyle by world standards.
Yeah, we do.
And I'm not changing much.
I understand exactly what you're saying, and I have more than one car. And one of the cars eats gas. One of them doesn't. But it's a question of settling at your own hash, so to speak. And one of the ways that I think I'm doing it, if I can, is it's not just the investment thing that we're talking about. It's other stuff that's going on in my mind and my head. I consider myself now to be much more of a climate guy than an investor. I spend much more time doing climate-oriented things than I do doing investment things. And let's just talk about the North for a minute. The biggest threat from the North is the permafrost. And the permafrost has two sides. One side we know about, and the government's paying attention. There's two sides to this coin. One is, how does the climate affect the permafrost? And it affects it in ways that are extremely nasty for the people who live there, and the flora and the fauna and the bears and everybody else. And there's no good stories coming out of that side of it. And this government spends about 95% of its Arctic money, climate money, on side A. Side B is the other side. And side B is, what's the effect of the permafrost on the climate? How much emissions are we facing in the next whenever. I mean, I don't know, 400 years. What's the speed with which the permafrost is going to thaw and the microbes that are embedded in the permafrost are going to do their little thing on the carbon that's thawed? There's twice as much carbon contained in just in the permafrost as there is in the atmosphere. And so let's say by the end of this century, 10% of the carbon in the permafrost is thawed. That's equivalent to 2/3 of the amount of carbon the humans have put up, just coming from the permafrost in the next 80 years. And some of that's carbon dioxide and some of that is methane. I think that I'm one of the very first guys ever to try, I did this 2005, ever to try to chart the amount potentially that's coming out of the permafrost. And it was a wicked exercise because I couldn't find anything out there upon which to base my estimates.
What did you find?
I found myself looking at a whole bunch of numbers and drawing pretty curves on Excel spreadsheets.
And what did you conclude?
I concluded that we have an extremely nasty problem. And then, in fact, it was entirely likely that the half of the permafrost could thaw in the next 400 years.
Next?
400 years. Half in 400 years.
Right? Oh, which that is, sounds which not is, a problem.
No, but that's only 10% by the end of this century. So recently, much better stuff has come out. And the shocking thing for me is that my nice little curve drawing wasn't that far off.
The shocking thing to me is that there aren't scientists in government and academia who would make their careers answering that side B question.
There are, but they're not Canadian. They are American and European. And I'm still the only, I mean, I toot my own horn here. He who tooteth not his own horn, his horn shall not be tooteth, right? There's still nobody who has said, what's it going to cost Canada to fix it? What's it going to cost us to fix our share of it? And so I have persuaded the federal government that we will pull together a consortium, a working plan to bring in people from all over the world, including Canadians, to try and come up with estimates of how serious the problem is from a physical perspective, how much carbon dioxide, how much methane. Two papers have been written recently that talk about the cost to the globe of the permafrost thaw. And of course, we have about 35%. The Russians have 45% and others have. You can guess how much time and effort the Russians are spending this. In fact, no government anywhere in the world has a coordinated plan to deal with this. But the most fundamental thing that I'm trying to figure out is how much is it going to cost us to fix our share of it? And my best guess is the same amount as we're spending on healthcare by 2060. And I will tell you, I don't think we can afford that.
We have premiers recently elected and otherwise, and potentially a prime minister, who is saying with respect to climate change, you, Canadian taxpayer, shouldn't have to spend anything, or at least we're not going to tax you.
That gets me to the other thing that I've been trying to persuade the government to do, and I thought I had made some steps forward, but I actually don't anymore, which is, I said, if you're going to ask Canadians to bear a cost to their pocketbook, one way or the other, it would be a good idea to pay attention to the old Fram air filter ad. Remember? Oil filter ad. Remember Fram oil filters? Anyway, Fram is a company that makes an oil filter. Think about the size of a Coke can that fits into your car and cleans up your crankcase oil so you don't have to, A, fix your car or whatever. Anyway, they had this wonderful TV ad with two people in it. And the ad lasted like 20 seconds. And it was, the guy in the front says, holds up a thing and he says, this is a Fram oil filter and it's going to cost you $12 and you can pay me now. Or the guy in the background who's fixing an engine says, or you can pay me later.
Nice.
So for asking people to pay now, wouldn't it be a good idea to give them an idea of what pay me later is going to amount to? And so I ask many, just about everybody who cares to get into conversation about this, and it's not everybody, what do you think of that? What do you think, would it help you if you had some idea of what it was going to cost you if we don't get this fixed? And to a person, they all say yes. They would. So I thought that I had persuaded the government to take its its expert institute. It's put together a consortium of about 25 Canadian institutions to get them to do an economic review like that. But what I really asked them to do was talk to the marketplace before they did the review. And the marketplace are people. It's us folks. It's us chickens. It's us kids. It's us kids' kids. What do you want to know? And what form do you want it in? So that if we go to the work of doing this exercise, it's something that you cared about and want to use in making your future judgments about things like, how much should I pay now compared to paying it later?
What do you think the chickens would say?
Us chickens? Everybody I talked to. What would they want to know? I don't know.
No. What is it that they would be willing to spend their money on?
I don't
that
know.
Really matters to them.
I don't know the answer to that question, which is why I think it ought to be asked. I'm not going to sit here and predict what your average person thinks is the important part of it. I mean, that's what the governments up to now have done. They have said, let's have this study. It's called the National Roundtable on the Economy and the Environment. It was published in 2011, and hardly anybody read it because it was so obscure that it didn't make any difference. People couldn't understand what the hell was going on. So I took that as I read the thing, and I thought, wouldn't it be a good idea if Canadians had expressed their perspective on what counts for them? Give them some choices and see what happens. Anyway, I don't think it's going to happen, and I'm disappointed. So I did put a group together, a powerful group of individuals. There was no lobby effort here. It was just some people that ought to care about this subject matter who'd had past experience in government. So included three former deputy ministers, one of whom was a deputy minister of the environment and clerk of the Privy Council. It included former president of Decima Research. It included one of the world's leading climate psychologists on why people care or don't care and what should we do about it. And so this group met with the deputy minister, and the deputy minister liked what he heard. And now there's silence.
So
Paul, what's-his-face's sounds of silence.
Why? Why?
Because as
every report comes out increasingly, as you noted, it's really worse than we expected.
Yes.
The risk assessors, whether they're in government or the private sector, are no longer in even passive, much less active denial. And yet,
that's
silence.
Correct. Right. Yes. Yes. I just don't know.
That suggests fear of some kind.
No, I think the part of the problem is it's, you know, if you're an important civil servant back in Ottawa, who the hell's Mike Brown anyway? And so why should we pay attention to that? We've got other things to worry about. We have other political issues to worry about. We've got our own careers to worry about. We have our own way of doing things to worry about. We don't have to worry about that stuff.
Nope. Can't let them off the hook. Come on. I get the politics. That's for politicians. But if you, again, are to advise the politician and you see a risk that is existential and yet you say nothing, that's not only irresponsible, that's a dereliction of duty. And at some point...
The question is partly this. How much time and effort do you spend doing that compared to making what you think is a bigger impact by doing something else? So I will tell you that what a study that I have been told several times, conducted by a thing called the Council of Canadian Academies, is being published next month. The Council of Canadian Academies is an Ottawa institution that's set up to answer questions posed by the Minister of National in our camp, National Resources. And in about, July of last year, they were given a task to examine the risks of climate change to Canada. So I thought, terrific. My particular interest in that stage was the permafrost. And I thought, would they be interested to look at the permafrost problem? The answer came back was, we decide what we'll do. Mr. Brown. Oh, and by the way, this was not a study commissioned by Environment Canada. This was a study commissioned by Treasury Board. Oh. So I know it sounds wildly aggressive, but I decided that since it was October by then and the study was due in June, I would write my review of the study in October. And so I said how much I was looking forward to hearing from expert A and expert B, David Schindler, about water on the prairies, and David Keith about geoengineering, and so-and-so about such and such, knowing perfectly well they'd never talked to these guys. So this study's coming in June. This will be, up to this point, the best the government has. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether it's any good, right? I probably will run and hide, you know, hide my own really quite sort of snotty review of this, because it wasn't very nice for me to do
price
that.
Price tags will post that, Mike.
Yeah, well, I'll make sure you get it. I'll make sure you get it.
You know, I can understand why when you walk into certain rooms, there's a lot of eye rolling. There's Mike again.
I'm a member of an organization that it's sort of known around town a little bit. I won't get into it a lot, except that it's a lot it's a lunch organization, and it's not Kiwanis or anything like that. It's a private thing of people in the town who are very good people. And I was given an opportunity by the person who leads this to talk about climate 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I thought, they all know what the hell Mike Brown wants to talk about. They don't need another Mike Brown lecture. I mean, who cares? So I said, all right, every one of the 30 of you, nominate yourself to be a minister of the crown. And we are going to have this luncheon session is going to be the cabinet meeting. And the topic of a cabinet meeting is, what the hell are we going to do? And by the way, here are your briefing papers, which happen to be media things that the assistant, I'm the minister of the environment, and I need some answers here. All the briefing papers are papers, media things in the last 2 weeks. And I was astonished by how much I found to put in this. So I took it to the meeting, and it was broadcast for about a, people had about a day to think about this, because it was all done at very short notice. One of the guys for whom I have a lot of respect said a number of things. I'm the minister of whatever. But he said the most fundamental thing is, we got to turn this from an economic, from a politically oriented discourse to being nonpartisan. So that's a real clue. We got to figure out how to make it nonpartisan. And he said, I've been around a long time doing a lot of stuff, but he said, the task you gave us today made me think more about any other subject that this group has faced in the last 2 or 3 years. So I took that, and other people echoed similar sentiments. I took that to mean that there is an underlying concern that many people don't know how to apply, but they'd like to. And they'd like to do it, and some of these were partisan people. They'd like to do it in a nonpartisan way, so that if you could put the facts on the table as best you can, let people argue about the way to solve the problem. Let's not argue about the recognition that there's a factual problem here.
Do they also fear hypocrisy, that if you really cared, you wouldn't do ABC?
No pipeline. Not really. That wasn't the focus of what I was trying to get at.
But do
you
think,
are there some people who are like that? Oh, sure.
I think we all fear it.
We all are, frankly. We all are. Yeah. You know, hey, I drive around in my nice little electric car thinking I'm burning sunshine. But the fact is, somebody had to produce that car, and it burned a lot more than sunshine to make the car. And so we're all hypocrites to a certain extent. But I really believe, and I do buy electric, I bought an electric car, okay? And the stunning lesson from buying the electric car is that it's a better car. And I would never buy another kind of car, if only because this is the best car, is a car I've ever owned.
So
that's a clue as to how we have to help solve the problem, is to give people answers that are better answers than they have now.
Or the promise of a better life, actually.
That's part of the better answer. That's part of the better answer. I mean, if you could do things without having to spend money or to spend carbon doing them and be just as happy at the end of the day, why can't you persuade people to do that?
How about this? Am I tired of feeling like a hypocrite? Buy this.
So do you know who carries that message? My grandchildren.
Yeah.
That's my grandchildren's message. And they actually say it to their parents. So there was an article out the other day. The most effective influence on sort of middle-aged people are teenage girls. Teenage girls. And I don't know if you know about it, but there are groups now of young women who have banded together to talk about not having children from the supply side and the demand side. One side is, if you have kids, they're all going to be habitual carbon criminals, right? You can't do much about it. The other side is, if you have kids, you are consigning them to a life that is potentially awful. And so birth rates in the educated countries are falling faster than anybody thought. The population crisis is often put up by people as being, actually, what you really got to do is have fewer people. And, you know, there are a lot of people who talk that way. It's actually happening anyway. And the climate crisis is an impact. So I had breakfast this morning with a very interesting man that I won't get too far into it. But we talked about science-based solutions. And there are two types of science. We think of science mostly being physics and chemistry and biology. Those are the hard sciences. But there are the soft sciences. And the soft sciences are economics and psychology and politics. And this guy's perspective was the most important science is going to be political science.
One of the things the politicians are doing, Christine Boyle on this council, has brought forward a motion for the climate emergency. You see many cities adopting that.
Yes.
It's the new phrase.
Yes.
Do we really have an emergency in the sense of a crisis that we have to respond to today?
No. No. I think that that's a problem. I think the use of that terminology is a problem. I think what we have to do today is focus on what the policy direction is going to be within the next decade. And part of that policy direction, because we have to understand the economic, remember, I was brought up as an economist. I'm not a scientist or, right, I'm not a business. I didn't go to business school. I'm an economist, okay? And so as an economist, I look to see what's going to impact people from the perspective of let's get our head around the problem that 40% of Canadians, frankly, I think what it is, they have less than $200 of savings. How the hell can we solve our climate problem when we have this huge discrepancy in wealth levels? We're going to have to do both of these at the same time somehow. And frankly, I don't know the answer to those questions, but I think that's an incredibly important debate. That's a political science debate. You can't ask people who don't know where dinner's coming 2 weeks Thursday, and there's a lot of those people, to spend a lot of money trying to solve a problem that is only going to impact their grandchildren.
Climate emergency in this sense, though, does seem to me to be a driver of change. Best example would be the smoke we had this summer, the wildfires that we now expect, expect to be worse.
Mm-hmm.
Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Even a drought, which can be a fairly long-term thing, is seen as an emergency. Certainly a hurricane or anything now that we can tie directly. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of thing, though, we need and repeatedly and worse before we will get the scale of change?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that some of them are going to be small scale and are going to have an impact. So, for example, I heard the other day, one of the news items, that there are lakes and streams in the Yukon that are so low now that threaten the existence of the fish. And all you have to do is kill the fish once, and you don't have any fish. And how many times does that have to happen before people recognize that you, even if you try to solve the problem today, you can't, but you've got to start. And you've got to have a plan that talks about how you cause people to change their consumption habits, how you cause people to think differently about the impact of taxes, how you cause people to think differently about government deficits, and how you make decisions that are going to lead entrepreneurs and the capital markets to put more money into technology that is going to take a while to work itself out. That's the emergency.
Are you deceiving us and yourself?
By
believing that there's still time, that in fact if we make the right investments, have the right hardware, make the right political decisions, we do have the time?
I think if we'd had this discussion in about 1999 or 2000, the answer would have been yes. No.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you have to argue with yourself about that?
No. But I have to tell you that it's a very depressing thing to face on a regular basis. We may have run out. There's a book that I first heard about on Anna Maria Tremonti's program, you know, The Current. I think the book was written in 2013. And I think I heard about it in about 2015. And it's by two people, one of whom was dead when the book started to be written. Very interesting story, as a matter of fact. The guy's name is Dr. Ajit Varki, V-A-R-K-I. And it's called Denial and the Origin of the Human Brain. And he is a clinical, the word escapes me. Anyway, he understands the physical structure of the brain. It's one of the words begins with a P, and I've forgotten which one it is. Anyway, his contention is that the successful generations of humans were capable to understand that they were going to die, but that they couldn't think about it. Because if they thought about it, they couldn't ever do anything productive. I mean, if you spent your whole day thinking about I'm going to die, you just aren't going to make it. And so there was a genetic selection that women would prefer to marry men who were actually capable to go and do some work, and they could only do some work because they didn't think every day about dying. And the part of the book that I liked was Anna Maria said, okay, she said, there's a paragraph on the page such and such that says this applies to climate change. Is climate change one of that class of problem that if you thought about it every day, you couldn't function? So you have to deny part of it. And so I then thought, maybe I should be characterizing people into those who are capable to not think about really bad things, and those who use that in a constructive way to say, I just can't get my head around not thinking about it. And so the Koch brothers are the first, and David Suzuki is the second, as examples. So David Suzuki, in my mind, is one of this class of people who's capable to take catastrophe, realize that it's happening, and do something constructive about it. We owe those people huge debts of gratitude because they're able to do stuff that other people can't do. Now, I don't know whether the Koch brothers literally just ignore everything. I mean, I don't know. But it's certainly a way to look at how they must function when they go home at night and look at their kids and their kids' kids. Anyway, it was a very instructive book, and it's been a philosophical revelation to me to understand that I'm one of these guys, one way or the other, that there's not a day where I don't think something about some climate issue, some climate problem, but then I have to get on with life.
Did your participation in the Clouds of Change Task Force set that off?
That was, absolutely. That was a life changer for me. I've done lots of other reports and things like that or participated in them, all the way from climate change to security. Mike Harcourt asked me to be the first chairman of the BC Securities Policy Advisory Committee, and I can't imagine anything further away from climate than securities policy. And I did another one on that I started on access to Canadian companies of early stage funding for, you know, just starting up companies. And once again, totally different. They were all good, but Clouds of Change was easily the thing that left a bigger impression on me than anything. I think everybody who was in that was there because they cared. I mean, what did we meet? Every Saturday for a year, right? And the attendance was, very rarely did people miss. People cared about that. And you had to be taken by the fact that a broad selection of this community cared enough to spend all that time and effort and do it. And frankly, I thought the outcome was great. There's lots in there I didn't agree with. It didn't matter. The fact that it got done, that there were a lot of people who cared about things, some things more than I cared about, didn't matter. It was a life changer.
You did put in one thing you did care about. didn't go much further?
No, the carbon tax. No, that didn't go very far.
Pressing.
Yeah, well, it was actually a pretty good idea. And you remember who our mayor was, right?
Gordon Campbell.
And you remember who the premier was who put in the first carbon tax in this country.
The same man.
Yes, who claims that I taught him Sunday school, which is rubbish because I don't think I ever went to Sunday school. But there you go. So I don't know whether we can relate the two. I've never asked him, quite frankly. But it was a good idea, and because you may remember the idea was that people would offset it by everybody getting a fixed reduction in their ICBC premiums. So the offset was fixed reduction in ICBC premiums, and you would spend like 80% of the money providing that reduction and the other 20% buying more buses. But Libby Davies shot it down. I was very disappointed she shot it down. She shut it down because she said, what are you going to do about the single mom who has to take her child to daycare and then drive to Vancouver for work? And I hadn't thought of the answer to that question, and whatever. That was the end of that.
So you didn't go to Sunday school?
Actually, I think I probably did, but I didn't pay very much attention to it. I don't remember teaching Gordon Campbell, I'll put it that way.
Well, you do have a certain quality of preacher in you. What I'm wondering is whether you're God-fearing.
Whether I'm what?
God-fearing.
No. I'm not. I'm not a believer. I don't think that there's some mysterious being that somehow or other God is here. I think it's all explicable in logical terms. So I don't apply any form of religious belief to this issue. For me, it's an issue of logic, and it's an issue of understanding natural processes, which are not God-given because they can all have a decent explanation. And so I'm not going to depend on anything mystic at all. The great mystery to me here is, how do we take the obviousness of this and persuade enough people of the world that it's serious so that humanity can escape from what otherwise appears to be apparent, which is, this is its flaw. Humanity's flaw is it can't solve this problem.
Mike, you started on this 30 years ago. I hope it doesn't take another 30 before you can answer that.
If I'm still alive when it's 30, I'd be pleased to think about it. I'd probably be gaga long before that, if not in a box. So you can only do what you can do. And I just about cried when my youngest granddaughter, without telling me, left school, whatever it was, Friday week, and just took off. And her teachers didn't like it. And I thought that was great. Do it. Do more. And keep working along the line of don't get to be civil disobedient until it becomes necessary. But if civil disobedience is necessary from the young people, we got to support it.
I'm Mike Brown for The Next Generation. Glad we had a chance to talk to the Mike Brown of this one.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.